So today we will be looking at Dhammapada verses 271 and 272, which read as follows. Na sila bata matena bahusacena vapana atta va samadhi labena vivita sayanena va Pusami nekama sukhang aputu jana sevitang Bhikkhu visasamapadi apato asavakayam. Which means, not by mere rules and duties, nor by much learning or study, not even by the attainment of concentration, nor by a secluded dwelling. Not even by being able to say, I touch the bliss of renunciation that is unattainable by unenlightened beings. Does a bhikkhu reach reassurance so long as they have not attained the destruction of the asava, the pollutions, the defilement? So these verses were taught in regards to a large group of monks, or various groups of monks, in the time when the Buddha was living in Jetavana. It seems that even in the Buddha's time, there were many monks who had this wrong idea about their practice and about the practice and about the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha's teaching, the goal is to attain the asavakaya, the destruction of the asava. The asava being anything that creates a connection, in the sense of creates karma and perpetuates our engagement, our involvement with the world, such that we're born again and again and again without end. So anything that prevents us from being free. We all know that, and all of these monks seem to have this idea that that was the teaching of the Buddha, there was no problem there, but these monks had various misunderstandings about their own attainments and about the work they had left to do to attain the goal of the Buddha's teaching. So some of them, these are all monks, some of them thought that being a monk and being very proficient in the precepts, the many rules of the monastic life, and the many duties that monks have, duties like cleaning up before and after a meal, duties like going on alms round, duties like receiving a new monk when they arrive, or duties when leaving a monastery, duties teacher towards their students, students towards their teachers, elder monks to senior to junior monks, and so on and so on. Lots of duties, lots of rules. Some monks were very good in this, and because it's so involved, it became the sort of thing that led them to a sort of conceit. This attainment, the reassurance in their minds that they were good monks, which from by all appearances they were good monks, in the sense of being able to keep the rules and duties of a monk, but thought to themselves, well, this greatness, this attainment of ours, This is a real accomplishment, and certainly we are well accomplished in the Buddha's teaching, and so for us the attainment of enlightenment should be a very easy and simple thing to come to. Other monks were well learned. They had studied a lot, learned all of the Buddha's teaching, the Vinaya, the Sutta, the Abhidhamma, memorized and taught and discussed, and were able to debate the Buddha's teaching, had intellectual understanding of the Buddha's teaching, and thought to themselves, we are well accomplished. For us, the attainment of enlightenment is no difficult thing, because this knowledge will allow us to find the right path. Certainly we know all of the Buddha's teaching, so how could we possibly miss the way to go? How could we possibly fail to find the way? We have all this knowledge. It's like you have all the directions, you have a map right in front of you. How could you not find the destination? Other monks were well accomplished in samadhi, concentration. Their minds were well focused. Perhaps they were not yet experiencing Lokuttara samadhi, so they hadn't reached true cessation of suffering, but their minds were very calm, very peaceful. And knowing that this was such a great attainment, most people in the world are never able to experience this level of peace and of mind. People who are caught up in debt and ambition, in relationships, the many attachments, many pulls and binds that exist in the world. Their minds are also full of worry and stress and fear and greed and conflict, that they're never able to experience this. And so here we have this great peace and calm. This must be the way to Nibbana. And so being content with that, they felt that they were well attained and well on their way to become, felt reassured by this calm. None of this is very radical or none of this is unfamiliar, even in modern times. These sorts of monks and lay people exist. And so they as well became complacent and were very, very reassured and felt that they had done what needs to be done, and they were well on their way to attain Nibbana, to attain enlightenment. And finally, there was a group of enlightened beings. Enlightened in the sense of having seen Nibbana, probably many times. And they had attained to the state of what we call Anagami. So there are four stages of enlightenment: the Sotapanna, Sakadagami, Anagami, and Arahant. The Sotapanna is someone who has seen Nibbana at least once. They've entered into the experience of cessation of suffering, and so that has set them firmly on the path to enlightenment. So there is a great reassurance even from being a Sotapanna. Someone who is a Sotapanna will be reborn at most seven more lifetimes before they attain complete enlightenment. The Sakadagami is one who will only be born one more time. They've attenuated greed and anger to such a weak state that they basically have no strong anger, no strong lust or greed, and they will only be reborn at most one time. But an Anagami is completely eradicated through the successive and repeated attainment of cessation of Nibbana. They have freed themselves completely from all sensual desire and all aversion. So they have none of that. Their minds are perfectly calm. And this is where the Buddha said this nekamma sukhang, they've attained this bliss of renunciation, because they have renounced all sensuality and they attain this bliss that is unattainable by ordinary worldlings. But these anagami, so an anagami means they'll never be reborn again in the kama vachara, in the sensual realms. They will be reborn, but only in the sudhavasa, the pure abode, so as brahmas, as basically godlike beings. That's the most they could ever be reborn in, is in the very purest of existences before eventually attaining arahant. Now the arahat is someone who has attained asavakaya, the complete destruction of any small, minute, any bit of attachment or clinging or desire of any sort, any dependence, any need, any want, any requirement. They've given it all up. They're completely independent, completely free, and completely at peace. And this is the goal. So an arahat has nothing left to do, but an anagami still does. And so these anagamis were thinking, well, we're that close. We really are where we need to be. And of course, for almost every single Buddhist on earth, this is an enviable attainment that they could never wish, they could never hope for. Most Buddhists, it's going to take them lifetimes to become enlightened, if they ever do become enlightened. Of course, not all Buddhists are guaranteed to become enlightened ever. But for an anagami, they're certainly almost there. But for all of these beings, so these groups of monks, they went to see the Buddha. Some of them maybe, I don't know, it doesn't really say, but a group of them went to see the Buddha anyway. And at that time there was this tradition where monks who had attained reassurance, meaning those who had become arahat, those who had become free from the defilements, would go to see the Buddha, sit down quietly, and present themselves before the Buddha as one who had attained to this reassurance, meaning they were never going to be reborn again. They had no chance or possibility of ever being defiled or ever being greedy, angry, or deluded. Their minds were perfectly pure, and they were free. They had attained to the freedom from suffering that the Buddha himself attained. But these monks went and did that as well. They went and sat in front of the Buddha, expecting some sort of acknowledgement, I guess, from the Buddha in this way, but it doesn't really say. They just went to sit. And so the Buddha asked them, he said, what? Have you reached the matakapatang? Have you reached the height, the pinnacle? Have you reached the top? And these monks said, oh, whenever we want. It's not a big deal. We're almost there. Any day that we want to attain enlightenment, we could. We really are at that level of reassurance. We know that we are on our way. We have this reassurance. We're grateful and we're confident, and we revere the Buddha and his teachings, and we have put into practice the Buddha's teaching. We have this reassurance. And the Buddha taught this verse. He said, that's not how you should never be complacent or feel reassured in that way. And so he taught these two verses. It's a simple story, a simple teaching, but a very important one. Complacency is a big deal in the Buddha's teaching. It's not an urgent problem, but it is a problem. It's something that we have to face, we have to acknowledge, and as Buddhists, we have to deal with. Buddhists of all sorts have to deal with this complacency. Complacency is of two kinds, as we can see from the story. You can be complacent about your attainments, overestimating your attainments, or you can be complacent about the goal, underestimating the goal, or the path that is required to get to the goal. Both of these you can see in Buddhism today, and you could see in the time of the Buddha. So the overestimating of your attainments is of two kinds. You can overestimate in the sense of thinking you've attained something that you haven't. So a person might think they are a Sotapanna when they're not, might think they are a Sakadagami, Anagami, might even think they're an Arahata. You hear about this from time to time, lay people often claiming to be Arahats. You hear monks sometimes who make sketchy claims or hints at being an Arahant, being enlightened, when they still get angry, when they still have greed and that sort of thing. People who redefine these attainments, who say arahants can get angry, they can have greed. No, someone who is enlightened just doesn't follow after their emotions. They're still emotional. Often from people who have studied a lot, who twist and pervert the Buddha's teaching, distort the Buddha's teachings in their own way. But The other way is when people misunderstand the significance of their own attainments. So, for example, those who have perfect precepts might say, "Oh, I am really quite well accomplished in the Buddha's teaching by keeping these precepts," or so on. So they overestimate the importance of the greatness of their attainment. People who, as we mentioned, there are many different, various different ways in which this happens. And as far as underestimating the path that leads to the goal, this one you see as well, where it's actually much more common than most people think, this underestimation of the path. Especially, you see it especially in those who actually seriously undertake the path, in the practice of mindfulness, most especially. People who come to do courses at our center, at centers like this, are quite surprised at the challenge and the difficulty of simply just facing your experiences. It's something that we're not accustomed to, something that we're not taught to do, something that we're not ready to do for the most part. It's the greatest challenge there is, and of course the most valuable and most rewarding challenge to undertake. But it's an incredible challenge, and it's only through undertaking the practice of sati, the practice of the satipatthana, the practice of vipassana, that you're able to appreciate the greatness of the task. For those people who have never practiced vipassana, they will often consider themselves to be well accomplished and well able to attain enlightenment through whatever it is that they're doing, through the practice of dana, charity, through the practice of sila, through the ordination as a monk. Some people who think because they're a monk, just by being a monk, somehow they're going to magically become enlightenment. But only through the practice of mindfulness can you see how deep and how well entrenched our defilements are and how much work it really is going to take. But it's also quite encouraging, because you see that you're actually able to make progress on the path through the cultivation of mindfulness. Because you can see the task ahead of you, you're able to also see the progress that you're making, and you're able to see and verify that it is true progress, especially through the attainment of sotapanna and so on. You can clearly see the changes that occur in your mind and the progress that you're making. So in regards to the story, this is just a reminder to us of the danger related to complacency, because underestimation, overestimation, these lead to complacency. They lead us to reduce our effort and to become stagnant on the path, and to fail to progress further, which is also a danger for the Buddha Sasana. You can consider that perhaps you have time, and you going slowly is not a big deal, especially when you gain some measure of enlightenment or measure of attainment. But it's also a danger for the Buddha Sasana. It weakens Buddhism for us to stray from the path, and for us to become complacent and give up our dedication to the path. So something that we should be dedicated to confronting. And it's not something there's any mystery about how to fix, how to change, how to improve. Simply by confronting the objects of your complacency and that which leads you to be complacent, or greed or anger or so on, simply by being mindful. And by dedicating ourselves to mindfulness, we confront it. As for the verse, it gives details. The verses give details about the various ways in which, the various stages in which one might become complacent, that are the most common, perhaps. The first is in regards to ethics, sila, and watta. So sila refers to rules or precepts. Watta refers to duties. And as I said, this is a common problem for those who undertake the physical ordination. So the convention of undertaking the activity, the ceremony of becoming a Buddhist monk, putting on the robes, where once one becomes a monk, it becomes somehow often more difficult for them to progress, because they become complacent. They feel a sense of reassurance that they've done something great. They feel a sense of greatness, which is illusory. It's not really a greatness to just become a monk. You've put on a robe and you've undertaken a promise to keep certain precepts and to follow a certain livelihood. You've made a vow to follow a path, but it doesn't actually mean that you've done anything. You haven't actually followed the path. And so if a monk is complacent, if a monk becomes sort of content with their state of being a monk, then it can be very difficult for them to proceed. It's often easier for someone as a layperson to make progress because they can dedicate themselves to doing meditation courses. Sometimes a person will become a monk and not do any meditation or never undertake to do a meditation course. You see in our centers it's much more often lay people who come to do meditation courses. So the difficulty we have with the monkhood is that it can become a real source of ego, surprisingly, for those who undertake the ordination process, is that they become attached to their state of being a monk and become complacent and content with it. So this is not a surprising story to hear, that even in the time of the Buddha there were monks who were content with their perfection of ethics. And today you will see this in certain monasteries where monks are so good at keeping the monastic rules, so good at following and performing the duties, which are all great things. I mean, it's a really noble sort of life, but it has no intrinsic value. It's meant to support something else that you do, the practice of the cultivation of satipatthana and satipatthana vipassana. If you don't use it, it's like having a nice car full of gas and you just drive it around the block, or don't even drive it anywhere, just polish it or buff it with a cloth and keep it in your garage looking nice. You don't ever take it to any sort of destination worth visiting. The second is the great much learning. Someone who has undertaken to study, analyze, understand, teach, recite, learn the Buddha's teaching in whole or in part. Some people even today are able to learn the vast majority of the Buddha's teaching, learning the suttas, the Vinaya, the Abhidhamma, even studying the commentaries. Some monks are even able to memorize part or the majority even of the suttas and the Abhidhamma and the Vinaya. Some people are dedicated to chanting it, some people are dedicated to teaching it. And all of this is great. The Buddha said this is a real support. It's anatta karana. It's something that gives you a real refuge. Because as I said, you've got the map in front of you. Having all this knowledge can be a great asset. In theory, practically speaking, it's often quite the opposite, where those who are the most learned have the most difficulty following the teaching because they have so much doubt and so much analysis goes on, analyzing and obsessing over the nature of their experiences, comparing it to what they've learned or making a contrived idea about what they're experiencing based on what they've learned. So having expectations, preconceived ideas about what they're supposed to experience, which condition the actual experiences. This is someone who knows about the stages of knowledge and those sorts of things, and someone who knows about the three characteristics, has studied them, can be really stuck on their intellectual understanding of these things. So true wisdom that comes through the practice of mindfulness should be a real surprise. It should be something that challenges you deeply to the core, not something that is familiar to anyone, not something that you can look back and say, oh, I read about this in a book. It will never ever be like that. If it isn't challenging you, how could it possibly be of any value if it's something that you think you already know? And so what we find rather is that those who have great learning are stuck on that learning. Often they don't ever undertake the practice thinking that they already know the Buddha's teaching. And they'll have the idea often that the study itself is of value. If someone ever is to explain to them about the Four Noble Truths, the Three Characteristics, Satipatthana, Vipassana, they'll be able to say, yeah, I know all that. Of course, anyone who has undertaken the practice of mindfulness can vouch for the fact that they really don't know much of anything at all just because of their learning. The knowledge and the understanding that comes from true practice of the Dhamma is completely, utterly different from intellectual understanding. And so there's great ego that is able to crop up. I mean, the big thing is that the defilements are still able to arise in someone who has even the greatest learning. And so they can distort the learning, they can cling to the learning. There's often identification, I have learned a lot. Often they are pulled away from the practice, even if they have the greatest intention. They're pulled away because others want to learn the Dhamma as well. So they'll have students, they'll have to teach, they'll have people asking them questions, inviting them to give talks, inviting them to teach classes and so on. So very hard for them to ever find any time to practice, even if they have the greatest of intentions. Something that can be, obviously, is a double-edged sword, because there's such greatness in learning the Dhamma, and we appreciate those who have done great learning, because they'll be able to share the Dhamma with others. Even if they aren't enlightened themselves, sometimes teaching others, they'll be able to provide the path and lead others to enlightenment even before they themselves become enlightened. So we appreciate it, but it's certainly not something to be reassured about. You should never think that because I've learned all this, I'm sure to become enlightened, because obviously you learned it all, you can easily forget it all. Even in this life, as we get older, we might forget the Dhamma. But certainly when we pass away from this life, there's no reassurance that we'll take any of that knowledge with us into the next life. The third is the attainment of samadhi. So the attainment of concentration is it's easily as common a cause for complacency as the others. You see this throughout the Buddhist world, those who have attained to great states of calm, which of course are found in other religions, other spiritual practices as well, and have no real great significance beyond their ability to support the cultivation of Satipatthana Vipassana. But if you are content with your attainment of peace and calm, these states that come from tranquilizing the mind, from focusing on a single object, from cultivating this single-pointedness of mind, then if that is something that you're content with, then there is no real ability for you to progress or to find, well, to face the true challenge and the true path that the Buddha taught, which is the path of Satipatthana Vipassana, seeing the three characteristics. I mean, the biggest deal with samatha meditation is that it doesn't prepare you and often makes you averse to experiencing, to facing the three characteristics. So the practice of samatha doesn't lead you directly to experience the three characteristics, quite the opposite. In fact, in many ways, it's antithetical to seeing the three characteristics. Not that it's a bad thing, it can be great if used as a further support, but for those who are dedicated to samatha alone, it's very difficult for them to make the shift to be able to face impermanent suffering and non-self, because the practice of samatha is the opposite. When you practice tranquility, you gain this serenity, this absorption of mind. It's stable, it's satisfying, it's even controllable, or it appears to be controllable, because the mind can be directed in any which way, and because of the malleable, pliant, strong quality of the mind that is engaged in samatha practice, you're able to, I mean, it feels very much like you're able to control the mind. So you never, ever come close to being able to see impermanence, suffering, non-self. And why that's significant, of course, is because those are the things which lead us to true freedom, lead us to let go. Samatha is something you can cling to. During the practice of samatha, there's no opportunity for the arising of defilements. They are suppressed. They are unable to arise because the mind is so focused. But it's absolutely a common issue that people will, that practitioners of this will become attached to it, wishing for it, striving for it, clinging to it, and becoming, identifying with it, becoming conceited about it, gaining this sort of complacency, feeling like at any time I want, I can attain this calm, this peace. Of course, we see in cases where they have allowed their defilements to come up again, those who engage in their defilements, breaking the precepts, killing or stealing or lying or cheating or taking drugs and alcohol, that it's very easy to lose this attainment, that these attainments are not stable, they're not even controllable, they're not, of course, satisfying, because attain them as much as you want, they will never be enough. You will always have to again and again attain them to gain even the same, just the same ordinary state of peace and calm, which is comfortable, which is pleasant, but requires work, and will never not require work. Not in the same way that the attainment of enlightenment no longer requires you to strive. A person who has attained arahata is free. They have no more work that needs to be done. They have attained the goal. I mean, it's very different because it's related to wisdom, and wisdom makes you unable to give rise to greed, give rise to anger, give rise to delusion. Whereas simple concentration, I mean, it's just not enough. And this is a huge issue. I mean, it's not the worst of problems. As I said, someone who practices samatha has done a great thing. They have calmed their mind, and it can be a great support for the practice of vipassana, but they haven't done enough. And it's something that we see throughout the Buddhist world, those who make claims that this practice is sufficient, that people who gain this peace and gain this calm have done something significant and are able to rest and relax and be reassured that they are on the path. And they're not actually on the path, because they haven't even come close to seeing the three characteristics or letting go of anything, really. The fourth is, well, just a simple addition, is the cultivation of a secluded dwelling. And this might seem a little bit out of place. Why is this put here at the end? But it is an issue that you see in Buddhism, something that we have to address even in the practice of Satipatthana Vipassana, a secluded dwelling. The Buddha mentions this. I mean, I can appreciate him mentioning it. I don't claim to know why he taught what he taught or what his intentions were, but absolutely something that I think is worth teaching, simply because we see it as a problem for meditators, a subtle problem, where a person will come with the good intention of practicing Satipatthana Vipassana and will practice it, but will leave with a inflated sense of the value of their practice or of what they have gained through the through their dwelling in a secluded location. So coming here to live in the forest is peaceful, it's tranquilizing. And if you did nothing else but stay here without engaging in sensuality, just by staying in this secluded place, staying here without any stressors, without any any enticements to sensuality, over time you will become calm, you will become peaceful, and you will start to think, hey, maybe I'm really becoming enlightened just by being here. Common problem, even here in our center. And so a person who comes to do a meditation course will leave thinking that they have gained some great attainment, which often they have, but great by one standard is not great by another standard. And much of what you gain from living in a secluded dwelling is lost when you leave. When you leave this center, absolutely some of what you've gained will be lost, because that is not the gain that comes from the practice of mindfulness. Mindfulness doesn't have this power to make you feel calm all the time. Not at least until you attain anagami or arahant. But a person living in a secluded dwelling can over time, will over time, gain a sense of reassurance and well, gain a sense of peace and calm that can lead to false reassurance that will dissipate when they leave. And it can lead people who've done courses to feel like it was all a scam, it was all a sham, it was all temporary, that they've lost everything they've gained. So you have to be clear about what actually comes from the practice of mindfulness. It's not disproportionate to the amount of work that you put in. And sure, coming for a week or a month or months is a great thing, but it is only those weeks or months worth of cultivation and practice of mindfulness. It's not the end of the road. It's not something that should allow you to be complacent or make you feel confident that you have reached the goal by any means. It's really just the start. The course that we teach here is the foundation course. It's the beginning. After you've done that, you repeat again and again, week after week, month after month, year after year, again and again, practicing meditation, doing courses, and eventually, bit by bit, you do attain the goal, proportionate to the amount of work that you put in. But very easy to be overwhelmed by the, or become overconfident based on the level of calm that comes from living in the forest. And finally, the final one is the attainment of anagami. So the Buddha says, one can think, pusami, I touch nekamasukang, this bliss of renunciation, that ordinary worldling, aputu jana sevitang, ordinary people who have not become enlightened could never experience. An anagami is able to experience what we call nirodha samapatti. It's a very special attainment. I won't go into detail, but it's basically the perfect state of peace and calm that leads to the complete cessation of suffering. I mean, it's just the absolute highest attainment that comes from renunciation, from letting go. I mean, it's a really profound and great thing. So in a sense, this is not something that most people have to be all that concerned with. This sort of complacency, as I said, almost all Buddhists in the world would feel like, wow, if I could ever reach that state, I wouldn't even worry about whether I was complacent or not complacent. It's very, very close to the goal. But the Buddha, to make a point, pointed out that this is not enough. You can't come and sit here and expect me to acknowledge your attainment. You've still got more work to do. And so the real lesson, I think, here is not... Well, it's twofold, I guess. We should, those of us who have not yet attained, if you have, for someone who has not yet attained to at least a sotapanna, who has never seen nibbana, you should have a sense of urgency about the need to cultivate the practice in sincerity. That it is absolutely, the Buddha said, it's something that you should consider like a person whose head is on fire. A person who's, if they're wearing in the Buddhist time, I guess they wore these turbans. If you're wearing a turban and the turban is on fire, that's how urgent you should consider this situation. Because a person who hasn't attained sotapanna still has the doors to hell open to them. They can be reborn in the depths of hell. They can be reborn as an animal or as a ghost. There is a great amount of suffering potentially out there for them. There is no reassurance for them in the next life. But for a person who has undertaken the practice, who has dedicated themselves to the practice and feels that they have gained some level of attainment, it's not so much that we should feel a sense of we should feel stressed or worried or really afraid about the potential for suffering. It's that we should remember that this is the nature of the Buddhist teaching. This is the nature of the life as a Buddhist. It's the cultivation, it's development as an individual. That we should constantly consider that our life should be one of development. We are not, until we are at the final goal and we can say with certainty that we have no more greed, no more anger, no more delusion, no single asava, something that connects us and causes us to cling to anything in the world. Until we have reached that, there is still more work to do. And it doesn't mean we should push ourselves and stress about it and worry about it. It means that this is something we resign ourselves to, or we dedicate ourselves to. This is my life. My life is one of development. In everything I do, living my life, I try to live my life mindfully. I cultivate the practices of generosity, of ethics, of meditation. I cultivate all sorts of goodness. Why? Because this is my life as a Buddhist, because there is more work to do. The real lesson here is that we always think there is more to do, there is more that I can do. And we ask ourselves, what more can we do? What can I do now that will bring me closer to the goal? Buddhism is not a practice of complacency where we say, I am Buddhist and that is good and that is my duty. I have done my duty by becoming Buddhist, or I have done my duty by doing this or that. Until you have done this or that which has led you to led you and caused you to attain the asavakaya. You haven't done what needs to be done, and you should consider this is your life. Your life is one of of bettering yourself, of bringing yourself greater sense, greater peace, greater happiness, greater freedom from suffering. It's not to feel bad or to feel dissatisfied with your attainment, but to be reassured by it and to use it as an encouragement to find greater and greater attainments. Buddhism is about development and development upon development. Once we have developed ourselves to one level, we work to bring ourselves to the next level. So that's the Dhammapada for today. Thank you all for listening.